birds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly.
Yes, welcome to Animal Voices. Gandhi said, I do feel that spiritual progress does demand at some stage that we should cease to kill our fellow creatures for the satisfaction of our bodily wants. Every creature, that's what we always say in Animal Voices, every creature deserves to live a life in that promised Garden of Eden, the chickens, the turkeys, the pigs, and the cows. All of them have a right to live their lives free from cruelty, free from the harsh conditions that factory farming imposes on these wonderful members of the animal kingdom. Yes, what we want is not bigger cages. What we want is no cages. As we said, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. This program is presented to you by volunteer members of the Vancouver Humane Society, Earth Safe Canada, and the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. The views expressed in this program are not necessarily the views of the organizations involved. Our technician today is John Pranger. Thank you, John, for being here for us. And he's also our webmaster. And our webpage, on which many of our programs are posted, is animalvoices.org. My name is Carl, and our regular co-host, Marge Adams, is not with us today. We have a great program today, and shortly we'll be speaking with Reimar Krosher, who taught economics at Langara College for 30 years. At the half-hour mark, we will be speaking with Marika Mihailovic about the environmental issues facing the Friends of Clackwatt Sound organization. Well, welcome to Animal Voices, Reimar Krosher.
Well, happy to be here.
That's nice. And, well, you know, you were teaching at Langara College for 30 years, and you were teaching economics.
Yes, I was.
And, you know, one of the things you once mentioned to me was that John Robbins wrote a book about Diet for a New America. Maybe you can just give us a little outline of what he said there and what connection that has to economics.
Well, the book basically pointed out very clearly the immense environmental cost of the meat industry, the animal food industry, and the advantages of the much lesser cost which vegetarian production incurs. It also stressed the high price in terms of human health which meat consumers have to pay. That was the essence of the book. It went into great detail about these issues. Many of these issues have become a little more mainstream now, but at that time it was sort of new and almost revolutionary.
So then you made your students, you were an economics teacher, you were teaching economics at Langara, and you suggested or even promoted the idea that your students should read Diet for a New America by John Robbins. And were you ever challenged about that?
Well, let me first of all point out, Carl, that as an instructor at a college, one has that wonderful power of dictating to the students what they have to read. No choice. Required reading. There's a required reading list. They are expected to have some knowledge of the information, and they will be tested on the exams, and that may be worth as much as 25% of their grade. So they really basically have to accept what is put down in front of them. So, yes, so I made them read Diet for New America, required reading, and many other interesting ecological and environmental publications at that time to basically put some light on the downside of our present status quo economic system.
Now, some students wanted to challenge you on the validity of a diet or a book which basically promoted vegetarianism, veganism, to do with economics. And what happened when you were challenged?
Well, I had a class of marketing students who had to take economics because it was part of the program. They didn't really want to take it, so they weren't particularly motivated. And they, of course, had to also read these various publications. They didn't like it too much. I think marketing students may be more interested in making money than in ecological issues. So one of the students, apparently a group of students, went to the department head and complained that they had to read this material. And then the department head called me in, and I sort of presented my case, and the department head said, we will have to go and see the dean. And so we went and saw the dean.
And then?
And the dean said, we've had these complaints here about a material which students have to read in your class, which students think is not economics. So I asked the dean, what do you think is economics? And the dean, of course, didn't know. So the dean said, you tell me. So I said to the dean, the most widely accepted definition of economics is the study of what is produced, how it is produced, and for whom it is produced. Economics is not the study of what should be produced, how it should be produced, and for whom it should be produced. So if the production of food, if the production of animal food in our society is not economics, then please explain to me what is economics. Because the production of animal food, of course, is part of what is produced, how it is produced, and for whom. I made it clear in my classes that I wasn't pushing any particular idea. I never said people should become vegetarians. I simply pointed out this is the reality, these are the facts, these are the statistics. You don't normally read about these in the mainstream media, and I'm exposing you to them.
That's great. And so you were vindicated, and they had to read, to get good marks, they had to read Diet for a New America.
And Greenpeace material and all kinds of other material which basically examined what in mainstream economics is called externalities or negative externalities. And negative externalities refer to consequences outside our existing price system, undesirable consequences which are a byproduct of the given method of production.
Right. Now, You came here by bicycle today. Now, I know you live way up on the top of Lonsdale there, and for 30 years you traveled to Langara College mostly by bicycle.
For the last 12 years or so, yes, by bike. I enjoyed it a great deal.
What was your convincing the moment your road to Damascus, where suddenly you said, car, you're staying behind, I am pedaling, I'm using pedal power right now?
Well, I found I got quite stressed, you know, during rush hour traffic, driving from North Vancouver to Langara. I also found I had to build in some sort of time safety margin because of unexpected congestion. And I arrived at quarter after eight or so, stressed out to some extent, facing my first morning class, and sometimes it took me 45 minutes. I'd have to allow at least 45 minutes to get there. And I found that by using a bicycle, I could be there in an hour, and I didn't really need any safety margin. I would just basically cycle down the hill in North Van to the sea bus, jump on the sea bus, have a 10-minute relaxing ride on the sea bus, And then on the other side, avoiding the busy main streets that take me about 30 minutes or so to get to Langara. And I came there, refreshed my mind, full of oxygen, and happy to start my teaching.
Now, from your accent, we can gather that you're an immigrant. So you were born in Germany.
Yes, I was.
You were. During times of war, things were fairly difficult. You lived in Germany during the war?
Yes, I did. I was born in 1937, so I experienced the first 8 years of war, and then 1946-47, which we call the starvation years, because things were much worse even in 46 and 47 as far as food was concerned than during the war years.
So your father, jobs were quite difficult to get after the war or during the war, and your father wanted you to be in the meat industry, was it?
Yes, my parents yanked me out of school when I was 14 with minimum consultation and put me into a butcher apprenticeship, saying if you are a butcher, you will never have to be hungry again in your life. And not being hungry was a big issue in those days. So I ended up as an apprentice in a small village butcher shop. And on my first day that I arrived, all nicely decked out in the prevailing kind of garb of meat workers with rubber boots and big apron and long white coat. When I arrived in a little backyard, I saw about five pigs, one heifer, and one calf. And it occurred to me that we were going to slaughter these animals. And when that thought
struck... How old were you then?
I was 14. And when that thought struck me, I was just carrying two buckets of water. I put them down, and I ran away, and I hid for the rest of the day. And then at the end of the day, I showed up again. And the other two employees, the master and the journeyman, of course, teased me and egged me on and said, what kind of a man are you? You are not even, you're worse than a woman. You've got no guts, you've got no fortitude, you're a weakling, etc. And with these pleasant thoughts, I then went on the train and traveled home. And then, fortunately, the next... 5 days, we had a 6 day work week, 12 hours a day. The next 5 days were not slaughtering days, so we made bacon and ham and sausage, etc., which was interesting and not particularly violent. And then Sunday was our 1 day off, and then next Monday was slaughter day again, and that time I did not run away.
What happened then?
Well, the same thing that happened every Monday. Normally it'd be five or six pigs, a cow or heifer, and a calf. And we killed them. And your feelings, you become desensitized after a while to a point. But I noticed that the master, the owner of the business, who was in his mid-30s, I would say, who was a decorated veteran of World War II, so he had seen lots of things, I'm sure, that on Monday he was much more stressed than on any other day. He was a smoker. On Monday he would smoke 2-3 times the cigarettes, and on a normal day he would perspire because of some war injury. He only perspired on one half of his face, so it was more noticeable. He would perspire immensely on Monday, and as soon as the slaughter was finished, he would take off and let us do the rest. So evidently, it stressed him out a great deal as well. So, yeah, we slaughtered the animals.
So you had to lead the calf to the...
Well, the pigs... Pigs are really intelligent animals. The pigs knew exactly what was going to happen, and the pigs fought and they fought like human beings would fight, like human beings would fight that are going to be executed. They fought with intelligence and with desperation. So it was a task to kill the pigs. And the cow or the heifer would fight too. And to slaughter the heifer, it had to be moved from the little yard into the building. And heifers are very strong, and the three of us didn't have the strength to push it in there. And so we had a winch, and we winched the poor animal in and then slaughtered it. And the calves, normally there was one calf, and baby animals are even more beautiful than adult animals, and they have this childlike charm and trust. And the calves didn't really quite understand what was going on, and the calves would look you in the eye with trust, and they have beautiful dark brown eyes, the eyes of a child, and the calves would not fight. And it was just hell, really, to deal with the situation. And I somehow just managed to keep my sanity and push it all away and find some kind of mental escape, I guess. How I survived that period, I still don't really quite understand.
Anyway, you didn't last long there, and but you became... I mean, it's interesting that you say the butcher there was also stressed. I mean, he had some type of sensitivity towards animals, but... and, of course, you didn't become a butcher, thank goodness.
Well,
you emigrated and studied economics.
Yeah, my parents emigrated to Canada. I came here, I was 16 years old. I had a skill. I worked in the meat industry for a couple of years or so, making good money, making sure I was never in the slaughter department, making excellent money at that time, and I found out that there was really no future. I didn't really enjoy the work. There wasn't a future in it, so I decided to go back to school and then eventually go to UBC and UCLA and end up teaching economics.
Now, you mentioned how you thought, how you said that pigs were really intelligent, and of course they had wild boars in those days in Germany.
Yes, they still do. They still have them. They still have them in Europe. The farmers consider them quite a plague. They live in herds. When they feed on a field, a herd of pigs feeds in a field. When the farmer arrives in the morning, you have the area of maybe one or two tennis courts completely devastated. They love, particularly, they love potatoes, and the Europeans grow a lot of potatoes. And so in Germany at that time, pigs were the one wild animal for which there was no hunting season. They could be hunted at any time. So the hunters, the village hunters, would take off in the morning and come back later on, and sometimes they shoot a pig, but most of the times they came back empty-handed. And then the farmers switched to poison, to try to poison the pigs, but pigs are really intelligent, and they figured out very quickly the poison didn't do them any good, and they didn't touch it. And then the hunting intensified again. The pigs became more and more nocturnal, did their feeding at night, and it was really difficult for the hunters to knock them off at night. And I went along pig hunting a few times. It was really most boring because we were sitting in the bushes and the hunters never shot anything. And when we went out pig hunting, the pigs put up sentries at each corner of the field. They had a sentry. And we approached the field, and you could hear the whistle. And the hunters would say, "Done!" And by the time the hunters made it there, the pigs were gone. So I understand they still don't have a hunting season on wild pigs. They are social animals. They are extremely intelligent. They're adaptable. They look after their own herd. And I suppose one could make the point that they look after their own herd better than human beings do.
And so do the Canada geese, of course.
Well, the Canada geese, I came across this interesting story about Canada geese, which migrate. Most of them migrate. In the winter they head south, in the summer they head north. They fly in V formation. And the front goose is really taking the brunt, because the V formation, the following geese save up to one third of the energy by flying in V formation, and the up front you have the strongest members of the tribe who constantly alternate, so the main expenditure of energy is done by the young strong geese. And they're fantastic navigators, of course. They have a navigation. They always know exactly where they want to go, and they end up there. They have a navigation system which we do not understand. And when a goose becomes sick during migration, then that goose will be left behind with two strong geese. And they attempt to help the sick one. If the sick one recovers, then the three of them attempt to catch up with the flock, and the two strong ones constantly change the front position to give the sick one or the one that was sick the break. And if the sick one dies, then the two strong ones catch up with the main flock, and they fly in a straight line formation, changing position all the time. So I was impressed by the story because it indicates to me a social system which geese have of looking after the old and the sick that we as human beings could learn something from.
Thank you, Reimer. Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio. We're speaking with Reimer Crocher, who's been telling us some wonderful animal stories. He used to be an economics lecturer at Langara College. And we're gonna come back to Reimer, but maybe we're going to have just a little song here in between, and it's going to be Dana Lyons playing I Am an Animal, and then we'll talk about pesticides and democracy, a la Reimer Crocher.
Like animals, we love like animals, we all are animals, we all are animals. The reptiles have some class, they slither about in the grass, they like it when the weather's damp, they party deep in the swamp. They've got smooth and shiny scales, long tongues and longer tails. Ooh. Birds do it all with their beaks. They eat and they clean and they speak. Their wings take them high in the air, and who knows what they do up there. They've got dances that can't be beat, with their feathers and rubber feet. Tweet, tweet. I am an animal, you are an animal, we both are animals, we both eat animals, we dance like animals, we love like animals, we all are animals, we all are animals. The insects have some pride, they wear their skeletons outside. They can live anywhere, hot or cold, they do not care. With antennas and many eyes, they eat, reproduce, and they die. Ha! Are a wild bunch.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio. And that was Dana Lyons reminding us that we are animals. And we've had the privilege of having Reimar Kroscher in the studio today, and he's telling animal stories. And thanks for all those wonderful animal stories, Reimar. But at some time or other, you know, we heard how you were nearly inducted into the meat industry, but then somehow or other things changed and you saw a different piper call the tune. And how did you see the light? What happened to you?
Well, one day about 33 years ago or so, I was in our basement. I had bought a hind quarter of beef and I was taking it apart and wrapping it in freezer paper and putting in a freezer. You could save quite a bit of money that way. And my wife, Chris, came down the steps and she looked at me and she said, you know, that looks disgusting. All that meat on the table. And I took back two or three steps and I looked at it and said, you know, I agree. And she said, you know, I could live without eating all of that meat. And I said, you know, I could too. So we became vegetarians at that point. Mind you, we had a freezer full of meat. We had to eat that first. But after that, we became vegetarians. And that was about 32 or 33 years ago. And there were really no vegetarians to speak of in the greater Vancouver area. There was only one vegetarian restaurant, the Nom. The concern at that time was, can vegetarians get enough protein to live a healthy lifestyle? And there was a lot of emphasis on mixing grains, you know, making sure you mix grains and beans, etc., etc. So
complete protein.
We were sort of outnumbered badly at that time. My parents thought we had gone crazy. Our kids, especially my older daughter Sonia, didn't especially like the new vegetarian diet. My parents wouldn't invite the grandchildren and feed them meat and eggs to make sure they get enough protein. So it was an exciting time. And then about 10 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, we became vegans. And I find I'm thriving on that diet. And to some extent, I think the experiences which I have related, the slaughterhouse experiences, were sort of hidden in my subconscious mind. And they surfaced and they really helped. They induced me to become vegetarian and then vegan.
Now, recently I was in South Africa and we had a 50th class reunion and met many wonderful people who were just helping so many people, orphans with AIDS, people in hospitals. And I gave them some of the information about, you know, factory farming, and they all eat meat eaters and eating factory farmed and distributing it to the people as a great gift. And to hungry people it is. But then I asked him, don't you see a conflict there in being such a compassionate person and yet to not be aware, not practicing or being cognizant of how your meat is produced? And he gave me a four-word answer which satisfied me, and he said, we all have conflicts. And I didn't pursue it any further. We all have conflicts. Now, when you changed to vegetarianism and you had difficulty with your family and the children and perceived attitudes, you overcame that. And tell me how you did that.
Well, to some extent, I think it's maybe part of my personality that if I believe in an idea and I experience a lot of resistance, it may strengthen the idea rather than weaken the idea. And so I basically buckled down. Chris and I buckled down. We did our research and we came to the conclusion that it was perfectly possible and not too complicated to get all the protein you needed on a vegetarian diet. And we did believe that all of this cruelty and slaughter and factory farming was not really in harmony with our values. So we just stuck to our guns and persisted, and our friends and relatives basically began to accept us as being maybe somewhat strange. And initially also we may have had a fair amount of the sort of enthusiasm of the newly converted people and lectured a lot to them of what they should be doing, which is never a good idea. But many of the friends overlooked that. And eventually, I suppose we were just a little bit ahead of our times, because then, five or 10 years later, came John Robbins' book. And more and more information came out that the meat, that the animal diet is really, if one is interested in good health in the long term, that the animal diet is the type of diet one really wants to minimize or at best avoid.
It seems in the last even 6 months, with people becoming more involved with caring about the environment, that they're also looking at the high cost to the environment of meat consumption. So are we looking at a new world here, Reimer?
Well, we're looking at a changing world. We are looking at a world where something which was really esoteric and way outside the box is becoming a little more mainstream all the time. And that trend is likely going to continue. I mean, the medicine, the doctors all now say, cut down on meat consumption, watch your animal fat, eat as many vegetables and beans and non-animal products as possible. So things are changing slowly in a direction which I really like.
Right. So in this changing world, the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom?
Who can predict the future, Carl? I cannot.
Well, you know, the media is so powerful, and that's why we're here on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. You're listening to Animal Voices. Our webpage is animalvoices.org, and many of our programs are posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org. Thank you, John, for always keeping that up to date. So, Reimer, you're a multifaceted teacher, and also the direct democracy issue has been quite at the forefront of your agenda. So maybe you can tell us some of what goes through your mind. Are we really a democracy, or is this pseudo? Is this what needs to be changed in the electoral base?
Well, first of all, let me define direct democracy. Direct democracy means that citizens can initiate referendums or referenda, and that governments will or can initiate referendums or referenda with a focus on citizens. And we do not really have this in Canada. We have what I would call a pseudo-democracy or a make-believe democracy. Canadians at the federal level have democracy one day every 4 years, which is voting day. And 4 years is what? It's about 1,600 days or so. So we have democracy one day every 1,600 days. That is really the only time that politicians will listen to the people, and then they're out there on their own for 4 or 5 years. And normally they will say, if you don't like the policies which do, you can boot us out and you can put somebody else in. But so many of the policies are non-reversible. So, to some extent, we have given away our power. How do you reverse or undo the Gateway Project if you don't like it? How do you reverse or undo if some government comes along and gets rid of the agricultural land reserve in BC? You know, you can't reverse these policies.
So what we're saying is we need to change our system here of first person past the post?
Well, yes, we need to do that, in my opinion. And we need to liberate the population so that if 5 or 10% of the people have strong feelings on an issue, are agitated about an issue, that they can issue a referendum like they have in many other countries, Switzerland, for example. And if the people then vote in favor of this particular issue, well, then let's have it. And if they vote against it, then let's not have it. So that, the, you know, and to some extent, the politicians do not have unlimited power for 4 years. That's what I think we need.
So let's vote for this environmental. It would certainly be an advantage to the environmentalists if the system got changed. Reimer, we're going to come back to you, but we do have... you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM. And on the line we have Marika Mikhailovic. She is a forest campaigner for the Friends of Clackwatt Sound. Welcome to Animal Voices, Marika.
Hi, Carl. How are you?
Well, just fine. And great to hear your voice. And, you know, I was wondering whether you could tell our listeners some of the issues that you are involved with.
Yes, I work for Friends of Clackwatt Sound. And since 1979, Friends of Clackwatt Sound have been working to protect the ancient temperate rainforest of Clackwatt Sound, which is a globally rare ecosystem, as well as it's ecologically important on Vancouver Island, where three-quarters of the original productive forest has been clear-cut. And I don't know if people know where Clackwatt Sound is or what it is. It's an area of ancient temperate rainforest and ocean on the west coast of Vancouver Island, about a 3 hours drive west of Nanaimo, and the town of Tofino and Long Beach and Pacific Rim National Park are in Clackwatt. And Clackwatt Sound is also the wilderness core of Vancouver Island. And when you fly over the island, as I've done, you can see that Clackwatt Sound stands out as an oasis of green in a sea of clear cuts, and it contains the largest area of undisturbed forest remaining on the island and the island's only cluster of intact or pristine valleys that have never been disturbed by logging or other industrial activities. So it's a special place on Vancouver Island.
So now this is an area of about 1,000 square miles.
Yes.
And that's enormous.
It's about 8% of the land area of Vancouver Island.
And now you painted a beautiful, a bucolic view of green pastures, but underneath all this, as they say, the little devil stirs around. And maybe you can tell us about some of the issues that need to be resolved here with the old growth forests.
Yes, many people think that because of the big anti-logging protests of 1993 that Friends of Clackwatt Sound led, and also the designation of Clackwatt Sound as a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve in the year 2000. They think that Clackwatt Sound's ancient forest is fully protected, but that's not the case. Less than one quarter of our ancient forest is protected in parks, and the rest is open for logging. And logging of old-growth forest has never stopped here, although there's less of it, and it is somewhat better than it used to be, mostly as a result of the changes brought about by the 1993 protests. And right now, the Friends of Clackwatt Sound, our forest campaign, focuses on achieving permanent legislative protection for Clackwatt Sound's intact valleys, which are, you know, treasure troves of biodiversity and also huge stores of carbon. And if logged, will release a lot of global warming carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So we're working with local First Nations who now own the two major logging companies in Clackwatt Sound and with the provincial government to come up with a solution that would protect these valleys from logging and provide alternative economic opportunities and jobs for First Nations.
So maybe you can give us an example of how one can, create jobs and still protect the old-growth forests.
Yes, because right now we have no value-added wood manufacturing in Clackwatt Sound to speak of. All the logging companies, they truck or barge raw logs out of Clackwatt to other mills to be made into low-value products like boards and pulp, and also some go for raw log export. And we could cut less and have more jobs. by making a maximum value out of each tree here in Clockwood Sound. We could be producing furniture and doors carved with First Nations designs, and various other, really high value First Nations art. And that requires a fair amount of capital investment. That's where the government would come in to fund resources and infrastructure for such a conservation, what we call a conservation-based economy that we are working to achieve here in Clockwood Sound for First Nations and for all residents.
Now, to work with First Nations and work with governments, and you people are presumably the mediators there and have your own interests, but it seems to me always that the wheels of the law and what change for the benefit, these wheels turn really slowly. But how do you perceive that?
Yes, they do. This is where, like, the power of the public does come in, and we do know that, you know, if governments and decision makers need a little bit of prompting to get them to change their minds, that we have the public behind us in wanting to protect Clockwood Sound, and we also have market campaigns that can be applied to persuade companies to change their ways. So. But yes, we have to help the pace of change, because if we were just left the government and industry on their own, it would just be business as usual.
Thank you, Marika, for pointing it in the right direction. And I want to say, when I read your webpage, I felt so enthusiastic about what you're doing. Friends of Clockwood Sound, it's focs.ca. And we have a very special interest in our program, Animal Voices. Yes, if people want to know where the web page is, I'll repeat it, focs.ca, friendsofclackquatsound.ca. But we have, at Animal Voices here, we have a real interest in preserving the old growth forests, because we know, I believe we know so little about that. And each part of the old growth forest is so different, and there are so many species that have yet to be discovered. What has your experience been?
Yes, although Clockwood Sound is probably the most studied to death place in BC, we still know so little. For example, there is this project that is studying soil mats high up in the canopy of ancient trees. And basically, pretty well every time they go up, they discover species new to science. And they anticipate that about at least a third of the insect species they discover will be previously unknown to science. And each of those intact, magnificent valleys that I was mentioning, I mean, each one is an irreplaceable, unique blueprint of nature that can never be replicated. So, yes, it's really precious, ecologically precious, what we have here.
Now, I love your phrase there, the blueprint of nature. Mm-hmm. That's such a wonderful phrase. But there's also the animal issue here, because the forests live in relationship with nature more so than humans do. And maybe you can tell us a bit about the animals that live in the Clackwood Sound area, the eagles, the wolves, the bears.
Yes, that's one of the things that we still have large enough areas where animals and plants, like, they have been continuously evolving since the ice retreated about 10,000 years ago. And so we still have the complete webs of life that are not disturbed by human industrial activity. And we have the whole, still we have the top predators, wolves, bears, cougars. And, you know, some of these animals have never seen a human or had to cross a road. And then we have, of course, all the eagles, and then we have a very rich marine life as well. Here is one of the, there's the richest marine fauna anywhere, and we have, the whales that people come to whale watch, and we have wild salmon still. We have incredible tide pools, mud flats. So, and you know, we're on a wintering ground and a migratory area for birds. So it's just it's teeming with life, and it's a magical place.
And now I love the old the story that is quite well known, but it's always worthwhile repeating about how these animals that feed on the salmon. That there's a relationship between the animals and the growth of the trees where in the areas where the animals have been feeding on salmon. Maybe you can just tell us about that.
Yeah, it's like where it's, we call it the salmon forest because you know when a salmon come to spawn in the fall, they die, and then their carcasses are eaten by bears, mostly the bears. They actually spread, they take the carcass into the forest, and then the remains are left there, and they fertilize the trees. So, in fact, there's been, like, marine nitrogen has been found in the tops of huge trees, you know, 100, 200, 300 feet up in the air. And so it's a seamless web of life between the forest and the ocean. And then, of course, you know, with all the rainfall, so then you also have all the terrestrial nutrients that are also washed back into the rivers and into the ocean. So it's a big loop of life.
It's a big cycle. Now, the Friends of Clackwood Sound were also involved with the fish farming. In the Clackwood Sound, do you have fish farms? And maybe you can just tell us what you people have been involved with and in regulating that.
Yes, in fact, Clackwood Sound has one of the highest numbers of salmon farms in BC. We have two companies here. One is Norwegian-owned, and one is partly owned by Japanese investors. And as you've probably heard, salmon farming, as currently practiced, has many negative environmental impacts, mostly caused by the method of farming, which is net pens suspended in the ocean, where there is free flow between the fish and the ocean, and so there is untreated sewage. You know, like one farm could have a million fish pooping, and also all the uneaten feed pellets, and all that is not treated, and it goes into the water. It also settles on the bottom and smothers the ocean bottom. Also, farms use chemicals, antibiotics, dyes, anti-fouling net chemicals, and all that just goes into the water. Also, there is transfer of disease and parasites from farmed salmon to wild salmon because, you know, it's all, you know, in the ocean, and wild fish swim by and can pick up, for example, sea lice, which can be lethal to young juvenile salmon. There's also the problem of deaths of marine mammals, mostly seals and sea lions, because, you know, they are fish eaters, and so when you dangle a net full of fish in the ocean, then they come and try to get at it, and they chew holes in, and then they get entangled, or they can't find their way out, and they drown. And also, farms are allowed to shoot seals and sea lions as nuisance pests. And then there's the escape of Atlantic salmon, because most of the salmon farmed in BC are Atlantics, which is obviously an alien species to Pacific waters, and one of the companies here farms Atlantic salmon. And in fact, just 2 months ago, a net pen with about 20,000 Atlantic salmon was ruptured at one of the farms. And luckily, it seems that the vast majority of the salmon were contained within an outer predator net, but a few are known to have escaped and have been seen in three nearby rivers and in the ocean. And, you know, that is a really big problem when you have an exotic species that can compete with wild salmon, that can, you know, compete for food, for space. They also eat wild salmon eggs and small wild salmon. And the big fear is that they could get established runs. They haven't done that yet, but that would be the worst-case scenario.
Now, Marika, you've so clearly illustrated all about the forests and also the forest issues and the fish. And if people go to your webpage, which is focs.ca, what do you suggest that they, the best thing they could do to become involved?
Well, we would love you to, yes, to read the website, inform yourself more. We'd love you to join as a member or donate, which you can do online. We'd also tell you that, you know, you can protect forests and wild salmon daily with your purchasing choices, because the one good thing about corporations is that they need us to buy their stuff, so we have influence over them. So you can, for example, not buy farmed salmon. You can ask your restaurant or your grocery store, is it farmed? And if it is, then you don't buy it. And you can also, especially with paper purchasing, which is what most people would buy, is to buy only like 100% post-consumer recycled paper or non-tree paper, because there's no need to make paper from trees.
Right. And, you know, there was a wonderful quote on your website from Margaret Mead.
Mm-hmm.
And I have it here. It said, "We would never buy paper made from dead bears, otter, salmon, and birds, from ruined native cultures, from destroyed species and destroyed lives, from ancient forests reduced to stumps and mud. But that's what we're buying when we buy paper made from old-growth, clear-cut trees." That's Margaret Mead writing.
Oh, and Margaret Atwood, actually.
Oh, Margaret
Atwood, you know, the famous Canadian author.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for correcting me here.
I don't think there was that much awareness back when Margaret Mead was around, although she did say some good things, too.
You know, we've got to thank you for being on Animal Voices, and you've been a very clear light.
Okay.
Bye for now.
Yes, okay. Bye-bye.
Well, yes, and we're back here in the studio, and thank you, Raimar, for continuing to stay here. We were talking with Raimar Crozier, who was a lecturer at Langara College for all of some 30 years. And anyway, so we've heard these wonderful animal stories. But Raimar has also been involved with the democracy issue. And maybe did you want to have a few just the words, and then maybe just over to you.
Yeah, I would like to. First of all, I really enjoyed the all this interesting information I heard about Clarkwood Sound. And it seems to me that is just a perfect issue that illustrates, one of the perfect issues that illustrates why we do not have a well-functioning democratic system. The people on Vancouver Island, the people that try to protect Clarkwood Sound, have really no tools, democratic tools at their disposal for 4 years or longer. They can hope that when the next election comes, that maybe some other government will come in which will see the point that Clarkwood Sound should be protected. But aside from that, they're basically paralyzed. The only thing they can do is collect money and negotiate with government and try to influence consumers not to buy certain specific products and, again, negotiate with industry. But political tools, which politicians would listen to, is not at their disposal. They cannot, for example, initiate a referendum whereby if they get 10% or better, even 5% of the signatures of voters in BC, that Clarkwood Sound should be set aside and should be protected. And then this is put to the people of BC in a referendum, and 51% or more than half the people vote in favor, that the hands of government and industry are tied. To me, that would be genuine democracy and people power. Once again, once Clarkwood Sound is logged, yes, we can kick out the present government and put in a new government, but it cannot undo what has been done.
That's true. Now, you've also been involved with the pesticide issue, which is, you know, up and coming. It's been left on a municipal level rather than a federal, provincial. But I heard one of the speakers in Victoria speaking out for legislation provincial-wide to ban pesticides. Why do you feel emotional about that?
Oh, there are so many reasons. I think we'll run out of time, Carl. To begin with, all the testing which is really done on pesticides, are they safe or are they not safe, is mostly, almost exclusively done by scientists working for the pesticide companies.
And we
no longer have a large, effective body of government scientists who do not get paid by industry and can remain impartial to do the testing. So when scientific information comes out nowadays on pesticides, on animals, on the safety of drugs, you name it, one wonders how much faith one can have in these figures. So that's just one point. Another point is the long-term consequences. Sure, this stuff may be okay for, as business scientists have determined, maybe for a few years if you are exposed to it, but what about the long-term consequences? Another issue is, does it make sense to test one or two particular pesticides on some unfortunate laboratory animals to see how well the animals survive, or you have a control group that doesn't get the pesticide and another one that does, and what are the differences between the two? Does that make sense when we know that as human beings we are not exposed to one pesticide or one herbicide, but we are exposed to a whole cocktail of these things on a daily basis? So that's just a few points to begin with.
Now, in closing here, we only have 1 minute left here, is that if we're growing all these animals, we're feeding them all crops that are genetically modified, and then they've been sprayed with all kinds of pesticides, fungicides, but surely you minimize the amount of pesticides you get into your body by eating lower on the food chain.
Yes, because the stuff goes up the food chain, right? In other words, it's bad enough if you eat wheat which has been sprayed, or maybe it's, you know, you get exposed to a certain amount of pesticides, but then if you eat cattle which have been eating a grain, you get much higher concentrated amounts of it. So to eat low on the food chain, I think, certainly is highly beneficial for the environment and highly beneficial for the consumer.
Right. And Reimer, thank you for coming in today. I'd like to remind you that Reimer came in from North Vancouver on his bicycle. He's retired, and he's enjoying his retirement by turning his tennis court into a garden. And maybe just in closing, maybe just tell us the principles of that, rooftop gardens.
Well, yes, I have a tennis court. I used to play a lot of tennis. I no longer do. So we're building some raised gardening beds on the tennis court and hoping to produce much more of our own food, which we will enjoy doing, and we know what kind of food we get, and if we have enough gardening space, we let some of the neighbors share in our fields.
Thank you for the bounty, Reimer Crosher. Yes, and Gandhi said, I do feel that spiritual progress does demand at some stage that we should cease to kill our fellow creatures for the satisfaction of our bodily wants. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices. La da 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 da.
Children here and those yet to come, seed by seed, in good soil, in good time, love can grow.